The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Julie Dannenbaum Memorial Culinary Arts Lecture. My name is Mimi Robertson, and I am Julie Dannenbaum's daughter. My mother, who endowed this lecture, authored 5 cookbooks and ran her creative cooking school for many years in Philadelphia. From the author event series to the new Culinary Literacy Center, the Free Library is dedicated to providing people of all ages with excellent programming and transformational resources. I encourage you all to check out the great programs coming up in the Culinary Literacy Center, from butchering to baking to fish without fear. Many of the library's most beloved programs and services are made possible only by help of private support from people like you. Please make a gift of whatever amount you are able to support the important work of the Free Library. You can do so at freelibrary.org/support. It is now my great pleasure to introduce one of our country's most acclaimed and celebrated food writers, Mark Bittman. He penned the Minimalist column for the New York Times for 13 years, and is the author of the ubiquitous series, How to Cook Everything, called The New Hip Joy of Cooking by the Washington Post. He has also won 2 James Beard Awards and the Julia Child General Cookbook Award. Mark Bittman believes we all have time to cook. We just need better recipes. And he does an excellent job of providing these dishes according to a starred review in the Publishers Weekly about his new cookbook, How to Cook Everything Fast. Quote, at over 1,000 pages, Bittman has delivered another brilliant comprehensive reference. Mark will be interviewed this evening by Maureen Fitzgerald, food editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Please join me in welcoming Mark and Maureen to the Free Library.
See why people say wow.
Okay. Wow. Hi.
It's a packed house. Thank you all so much for coming. We're so blessed to have Mark here with us. I have a few questions for you.
Excellent. I need my camera. Go ahead.
So you've evolved from a straight food writer to a columnist writing about food issues that touch on politics, the environment, public health, among other things. Can you explain the transition and what compelled you to take on some of these issues?
I could say I needed the money, but it wouldn't be for I don't know. How many questions do you have? I have to decide. Am I give the long version or the short version?
Give the long version.
All right. The long version could take 10 minutes, but okay. I became a recipe writer sort of by accident. I was a writer, and this is back in the late 70s, early 80s, and everything I tried to write about, no one was interested in. So this wasn't that funny at the time, to tell you the truth. And then I... This is going to start and end with me being arrogant, but really I'm a pretty nice person. But so the first
we'll be
time,
the judge of that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. The first time I was arrogant was I was in a karate class with this guy Chris Angerman, and at Yale. I had nothing to do with Yale except my wife was going there, so I got into the gym and I was in this karate class. This is too much detail. I'll have to fix this, but it's okay. And Chris was writing theater reviews for the local paper, the local so-called alternative weekly. And I said, how did you get that? And he said, just go in and ask them, do whatever. They'll let you do whatever you want. So I went into the office the next day. This is long before security or anything else. I walked into the guy's office, and I said, Chris Angerman told me that I could ask you to be your restaurant reviewer. And this is, I swear to God, this is a true story. And guy's name was George DeStefano. George said, we have a restaurant reviewer, and I said, I'll be better. So he said, you write a restaurant review, and if it's better, you're the restaurant reviewer. Because these other people, it was a couple, it was obvious they weren't that good. I mean, no offense, but I said I was going to be arrogant, so.
I'm glad you had at least read the restaurant review before you told them that you would be better.
So I spent 24 hours writing, not actually a restaurant review, but kind of a manifesto of restaurant reviews. Or a manifesto about restaurant reviewing. I was 29 years old, if you can believe that. And I became the restaurant reviewer. So then I accidentally started writing recipes. Really, these are good stories, actually, but would take too much time to tell each of them. And let's say 10 years went by and I became more or less successful. 15 years, I started writing for the Times, and I thought, well, I had never set out to be this person who wrote hundreds, then thousands of recipes. I certainly never thought I'd be a person who wrote a book called How to Cook Everything. And I thought, is this really where I wanted to be? And I thought, it's pretty good. It's justifiable. It's a good thing to be doing. And I thought. If I could get everybody in this country cooking rice and beans one time a week, I thought this would really have been an amazing career. And that's what I was thinking in the 80s and 90s. I mean, just to get people to cook the simplest, most straightforward, easiest, pretty healthy, you know, people weren't doing, they're still not doing that. So fast forward to, say, 2000 or so, it became clear. It became clear that writing any old recipes wasn't enough, that the writing was on the wall, and we were going to all have to move towards a more plant-based diet, and that the more plants we ate, the healthier we'd be, and the lighter our carbon footprints would be, and the less destructive we'd be. Because I started thinking that way, I decided to write How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, not because I wanted to embrace my inner vegetarian because he doesn't exist, but because I wanted to just be able to get more familiar with the lexicon of the food that I thought was becoming increasingly important, but we were becoming aware that it was. So fast forward another 5 years or so to 2005 or 2007, and Omnivore's Dilemma was published in 2006. Fast Food Nation was published probably in 99 or 2000. I mean, it was clear that people were able to write about food in a way that wasn't writing about cooking. And I was jealous, frankly, and I was sorry that I hadn't been forward-thinking enough to be where Eric and Michael were, which is fine. I mean, there's no grudges there, but you know, I felt well, I could do this too, and I started writing. The first really serious piece I wrote was called, and I owe this editor a great debt because it's such a great headline. The first serious piece I wrote was called "Taming the Meat Guzzler," and it was about how we overproduced and overconsumed meat and how bad that was for the climate and how bad that was for our bodies and so on and so forth. I did that for a few years and I became increasingly, and this also coincided with the VB6 stuff that I was doing, which is a kind of diet that I created, which is basically eat plants before 6 and then do whatever you want at night. We can talk about that at night. Or not. But I'm going to let you ask another question in a second. So
you pitched this column to the Times.
Well, wait, I'm going to tell you about the second time I was arrogant. So I made an appointment. The Times is a funny place because you can sort of talk to anybody you want. And I started talking to people and saying, you know, I'm a little disappointed that I can't find an outlet for these better kinds of stories that I want. But I can't, you know, I have to sell it every time. And someone said, just go to the opinion section. So I went up to the opinion section and I walked in. I mean, I made an appointment and I walked into, it wasn't like with George, and I walked into Andy's office and I said, you know, you have op-ed columnists on the economy, you have op-ed columnists on business. Food is as important as these things. Food is really, really important. Food ties into everything. And he said, well, is it sustainable as a column? Can you write it once or twice a week for years? And I said, why don't I have 75 ideas on your desk tomorrow morning? So I did that.
Wow. That's impressive. Have these ideas been building up in your head?
It took some work, but it didn't take a lot of work. I mean, now it's harder to come up with ideas because I've written those 75 columns.
Right.
I didn't say 150. You know? I'm probably at 200 columns at this point. So ironically, or perhaps not in keeping with my arrogance and my personality, the first opinion column I wrote was also a manifesto. So things came full circle. And I want to say one more thing, because in a way, when I got the opinion column, needless to say, I was ecstatic. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, and it's really hard. But it's an amazingly privileged position, and I remain ecstatic about it. But in another way, I'm 4 years into this, just about to start my fifth year as an opinion columnist, and I started to re-recognize how important cooking was. I mean, not that I ever stopped, but I started to think, yeah, well, this recipe writing stuff really is important because of the four or five themes that I keep returning to in the opinion column. One of them is how important cooking is.
You came full circle.
Yeah. So that was the long version, the semi-long version.
That's okay. It's very interesting. Now, very recently you wrote a column about McDonald's belief that their customers are resistant to change. Are you optimistic that some big food companies are getting the message that to remain profitable, they have to change?
No. I'm optimistic that that people will start new companies recognizing that the market is changing.
And some people have.
No, there's really good stuff going on out there. But McDonald's and Pepsi are not representative of those good things. That is not happening. Those people, they don't get it, and maybe it's too complicated for me to understand. It seems that it's because they're public companies. They have a certain level of profit they have to maintain, and every time they try to change, they fail. I don't think they have the guts. I don't think they have the perception. I don't think they have the commitment to succeed at doing things better. I think, you know, they're going down with the ship, and they are going to go down with the ship.
They basically say we're giving people what we want. We're a business.
We're giving people what they want, and they are giving some people what some people want, but what people want is changing, and they don't recognize that, or they recognize it, and their hands are tied. They just don't know how to do it. Pepsi does not know how to change.
Coca-Cola.
Well, Pepsi is just an example, yeah. McDonald's and Pepsi are flagships. They're not. There's 50, 100 big corporations like that. But, you know, we all know what we mean when we say McDonald's and Pepsi.
Do you think that it is a increasingly larger percentage of the population that's paying attention to these things?
Oh, yeah, no question. It's not measurable.
Or is it still a minority?
Oh, it's way minority, but there's a big difference between 5% and 8%. This is a huge country. I mean, for 350 million people. So if If 1% of the population is moving towards something, that's a big enough market for a lot of people to pay attention to. And if 10% of the population, 35 million people, are interested in something, that's, you know, that's half the size of England. I mean, that's a huge country.
And what do you think the percentage is?
I don't know. I always say 5. Maybe it's 7. Maybe it's 3. It's somewhere in the single digits. I mean, it depends what you're counting. What percentage of the population has a greater awareness of the importance of eating good food than did 20 years ago? 90%. You know, that's a huge number. What percentage is acting on it regularly? Much, much smaller.
Yeah, that's the point.
I'm not talking about locavores, vegans, people who go to farmers markets, people who only buy organic food. I don't think those are qualifications. I think people who recognize that real food is important, that cooking is important, that single ingredients are important, you know, that things that come in their own wrappers, they don't need to be processed, they are food already, an apple, a broccoli, whatever, that those things are important. That's a much bigger number than people who call themselves locavores, for example, which is a subset of that number. And of course, I suppose I would consider myself a locavore. Or I suppose I would, you know, I shop at farmers markets when I can, but I don't think those are not the highest priorities to me. The highest priority to me is recognizing that there's a thing called food that is what we should be eating, and that 80% of the stuff in the supermarket doesn't actually qualify. So what percentage of the population recognizes that? That's a pretty small number, I think. I mean, if you know, yeah.
So you're on this mission to get people to cook more.
Right.
What advice do you have for people who would like to cook more, but they maybe grew up in a house where their parents didn't cook, and they have a hard time? How do you get started?
Well, this is why I wrote fast. The mission is 30, you know, my mission is 30 years old at this point. I mean, this little thing I said about rice and beans before is true. If all of those people knew how to cook rice and beans, well, then they'd also, you know, basically know how to cook quinoa and vegetables, and certainly they could figure out how to cook fish, which is the easiest thing in the world to cook, and so on down the line. I mean, once you know how to cook something, you know how to cook a lot of things. I think most people recognize that. That may not be true of knowing how to cook scrambled eggs or a hamburger or a tuna fish sandwich, but once you know how to cook something that takes a little bit of simmering or a little bit of sauteing, or, you know, once you're not afraid of the equipment and not afraid of the heat and not afraid to screw up, I think once you get to that stage, you're on a springboard. You're ready to go. And the question is, how do we get people to that little, tiny little first step? How do we get people to not say, I don't know how to do this, I don't have the time to do this, I'm afraid to do this.
It's too much work.
And I always wind up comparing it to driving a car. Because if you expected to drive a car well the first time you drove a car, your expectations are really way too high. Because, you know, we've all driven into our share of telephone poles. or whatever. We've all certainly dented, you know, our doors or our fenders or whatever. And somehow, this is the disservice, and I'm not entirely anti-celebrity chef and food television and all that stuff, but I think it does a disservice by saying, well, food is competitive, it's bare knuckles, I can do it better than you, it's really hard, you have to be able to chop really fast, and I am continually asked to demonstrate how to chop an onion, and I refuse to do it because I don't really know the right way. Or I actually do know the right way, but I'm too lazy to do the right way. So the trick or the goal is to say to people, just try one thing, and you will like it, and you will be successful, and you will try it again. But you have to make a commitment. You have to make it a priority, and we can talk about the specifics of this book or not, as you like, but you know, without going too deeply into it just at this second, this book is, I think, my best shot at saying to people, this is the way I believe you can get yourself into the kitchen and not screw up. You really don't have anything to be afraid of. This is a sort of seamless new kind of recipe that anyone can do. I guess it remains to be seen how successful it is, but
let me say that a
lot of work went into it. So,
what is the premise behind it? I paged through it. The format is different. Kind of reject the mise en place,
right,
which is kind of the standard chef prep technique where you have everything ready and you kind of incorporate those steps into the actual preparation of the ingredients into the recipe.
Right.
I paged through it and it was disconcerting to me because I was like, well, what do I do with the onion? And I showed it to a younger colleague. She said, I love this. So it's
Mikey,
interesting.
You're used to the old thing. I mean,
Who is your audience? Is it everyone? Is it people who don't?
Well, it's people who don't cook for the most part.
Okay.
Which is a good enough audience, you know. I mean, I think I have I have fans. So people who know me, who like me,
they'll buy anything you.
Well, I don't want to say that, but they'll at least consider it.
Sure.
And there are great ideas for recipes in there, and there are reasons for. There are reasons for experienced cooks to buy this, too. I think there are a lot of good ideas. I think there's a lot of aha moments that we, because I worked with a team on this, really, that we came across in doing this that we thought, well, you know what? We all cut bell peppers the same way, even though it's not really the way that we were taught how to do it, and things like that.
It seems intuitive that you chop the onion while the water is boiling. But maybe for some new cooks, it's not so intuitive.
Well, we've all written recipes wrong. I mean, we've all written recipes from the point of view of a chef, which is to say, I'll tell you what, we'll go in the kitchen, and you and you and you will go chop onions. I want you to chop a box and pick some parsley and mince me 40 cloves of garlic and, so you know, peel 50 pounds of potatoes and slice them and so on down the line. And then I'll stand there and put that stuff together. Or better still, I'll tell someone else how to put it together. And that's what's represented in a traditional ingredient list and instructions, set of instructions. So what I did here is turn the ingredient list into kind of a shopping list.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here
mm-hmm.
is what you need. You got to have this stuff if you're going to make this recipe. But then the instructions part is broken down into preparation and cooking, which basically sort of means chopping or applying heat. But, you know, there's different kinds of preparation. There's different kinds of cooking. But and it is exactly what you just said. You walk into the kitchen, you put a pan on the stove, you turn the heat on under the pan, you put some oil in the pan, then you start chopping the onion. You have pulled the onion out of the larder or the refrigerator or whatever because you have a shopping list, but you chop it, you put it in the pan. Then the next thing is maybe you're slicing tomatoes, maybe you're dicing chicken, maybe you're mincing garlic, whatever it is you're doing. You do that and you go on to the next cooking step. And it sort of it takes advantage of the fact that cooking does take time, that by applying heat to something, it doesn't instantly cook. So there are these natural interludes during which experienced cooks do the prep work. And not experienced cooks have slavishly followed this list of things that they were supposed to do, and they have nice little bowls of things sitting around on a counter. But very often a 20-minute recipe, if you do a 20-minute recipe the old way, it takes 20 minutes just to put all that nice little stuff on the counter, and then you start cooking it. But if you do it this way, it all happens simultaneously or concurrently or whatever the word is. There's lots of other little stuff in there that's really, I think, really cool. Like there's options for doing things slower if you have more time, and there's options for doing things faster if you want to cut even more corners, because I think we all need to recognize that cooking is a compromise and that cooking something is always better than not cooking something. So you can cook not the best thing you ever cooked in your life, and it's much better than not cooking not the best thing you ever cooked in your life. Think about it. It's true. A lot of negatives there, but it's a positive statement.
Now, did you have people request this, or was this something that just sort of came to you? Or it's like when you're talking to people, they said, you know, it's confusing to me. What do I do when?
No. We invented this.
I mean, you invented it.
I had people come. When How to Cook Everything came out, there were three requests. One was, I don't want to know how to cook everything. I want to know how to cook something. Another was, I want pictures, which I addressed 2 years ago in How to Cook Everything, the basics, which is very pretty and has like 1,000 photographs. We don't mess around. And people who said, this is the response to, I can't get started. I don't know what to do. I can't get into the kitchen. And the other or original or whatever it is, How to Cook Everything, and this is not a rewrite of the yellow or the red How to Cook Everything. This is all new stuff. But the other How to Cook Everything can be very intimidating to people. Mm-hmm. It's the same number of pages as this. It's probably five times as many words as this. It's extremely dense. And this is because when we decided to do this book, when we first got the contract to do this book, we worked with two editors, two people who work for me who are basically recipe testers, recipe writers, thinkers also. I don't want to downgrade what they do. And two designers who didn't really agree on things. And we didn't really agree with the designers either. So we spent 6 months, and it wasn't that there was... It was our creative tension, let's say. It wasn't that we were fighting. It was that we had animated phone calls about the best way to do these things. And the result, it really took 5 or 6 months. The result were these different kinds of spreads that are in this book that we really believed were terrific teaching tools. So as I said, I think we'll see how it does. Maybe it won't sell. Maybe people will hate it, whatever. But I think it's really cool. I'm very proud of it.
Well, it sounds like in addition to sort of the change in the format, you also made a concerted effort to do manageable recipes, not as difficult.
Well, I've always done that because, you know, I've never been a chef and it's hard for me to do hard recipes because I don't do that. But I think, we write whether it's literature or cookbooks, we write the books that represent who we are at that moment. And I'm a much different person than I was in 1994 when I started writing How to Cook Everything. And this is really a representation of how I... It's really a representation of how I cook now. It's not only... You know, in a way, it's as if we had... It's almost as if we had someone watching how I did things and then translating that into these really well laid out, really well designed, I think pretty well written recipes that say, this is how someone who's been cooking for 40 years really does this kind of stuff. It's not as cut and dried as it always looks. It's really kind of a sausage making messy process, mm-hmm. but we're trying to make it flow. And because when you're in the kitchen, when you're an experienced cook, I mean, I still panic in the kitchen. I still, you know, I turn to people all the time and I say, I can't believe I've gotten myself into this mess. And it usually works out okay. And when you look back on it, you think, oh yeah, I kind of knew what I was doing. I just panicked a little bit. Well, I'm kind of neurotic anyway. So, but you pull things out of the refrigerator and you look at them. This is what I do because I don't use recipes. I write recipes. So I pull things out of the refrigerator and I look at them. I think of what's in the non-refrigerator in the rest of the kitchen and I look at them and something happens. I mean, it's not art, but it is creative. And I put them together more often than not in a way that I haven't put them together before. I mean, sometimes it's a minor change. I wrote a recipe in the Times yesterday for pasta with eggplant and tomatoes, and I had thought of slow roasting. It wasn't even my idea, actually. I thought of slow roasting the tomatoes before, instead of stewing them, really drying them out in a slow oven, because I had all afternoon. It was a rainy day. Nothing was going on. But that kind of process can be codified. Of course, once you write something down, your creativity's over, and then the interpretation of the person who's cooking the recipe kicks in. But the idea is to make it so that if someone actually follows the recipe, which many people don't, I can tell you a story about that in a second, it works. And if someone mm-hmm. wants to mess around with the recipe, well, that's okay too, as long as they know what they're doing. Like, there was this All Things Considered piece, the first piece about this book. I get in the studio, this is 10 days ago or so, I get in the studio and the woman says, I tried your chicken parmesan, which if there's a single recipe in this book that I'm like extra proud of, it's this chicken parmesan. It's like the greatest. Tried your chicken parmesan, it didn't work. I'm like, wait, this is All Things Considered? I'm trying to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
And that's not a good start.
First thing you say, and this is my first major interview, and what, how many people are listening to this? 10 million? And I said, listen, I tested that recipe myself. I wrote that recipe myself. And even though it's early days, I did that recipe 3 times in the last month on camera. I know that recipe works. She said, well, it's true. After I finished it, I read it more carefully, and I realized, I swear to God, I realized I was supposed to cut the chicken breasts in half this way before I started cooking them. That's why they were underdone. So I don't know. Probably could have been a better piece, but I feel like I weaseled my way out of it. Sort of.
You're modest to say that it's not hard, because it's so impressive, the number of recipes. How many recipes in this book?
Well, I don't know how many recipes, but it's 2,000 recipes and variations. And variations have always been an important part of everything I've done, but
every single recipe, there's like 10 different other ways that you can make it.
Well, two or three, I think. I think there's probably 600 recipes and 12 or 1,400 variations.
Are you like just constantly writing things down when you're cooking?
But you cook, so you know. Yeah, but
I never write anything down.
Well, I didn't. Yeah. But, you know, if you stir fry quinoa with cherry tomatoes and pine nuts and I don't know what else, a couple other things, you can then swap eggplant for the cherry tomatoes and peanuts for the pine nuts and cilantro for the parsley and blah, blah, blah. And I've been doing this a long time.
It sounds like it's just always turning over
yeah,
in your head.
It
really
is.
What if I tried
is.
It this way? And
yeah.
How about if I tried
well,
it that
or
way?
Well, I don't have parsley, so I happen to have cilantro. So that actually makes it different. I mean, I did try to write a book that didn't have recipes. One thing that I've done that a lot of people like, those of you who might remember it, was these series of 101 not recipes in the New York Times. Well, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, yes.
But they were like stir-fry quinoa with cherry tomatoes and pine nuts. That's it. That's the recipe. I mean, they were a little more complicated than that, but not much. And people loved those columns, but when I put that in a book, it flopped. People did not want a cookbook that didn't have recipes.
They didn't want to pay for it. They just wanted to get it in their regular New York Times food
section.
Well,
they had it for the most part, so that's true too. But no, people do, you know, people do buy cookbooks, and otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. So, but people do not buy cookbooks that don't have recipes, evidently. That's so what we're trying here is a cookbook that has a different, I think, new and improved version of the recipe. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
It looks good. Every single one of them in there look appealing, I have to admit. Do you cook every day?
No, I don't even cook. I was just like, when we were having this conversation back there, I mean, my life is a disaster.
I mean, when
at
you're
this
not,
point.
When you're well, not, when you're not on book tour.
I'm not cooking today, and I didn't cook yesterday because I was in New Haven, and I'm not cooking tomorrow because I'm in Washington. Saturday, I'm also in Washington. I think I have a date to cook with somebody. So, but that it's like it used to be that I'd cook every night and make dates to go out. Now I go out every night and make dates to cook. But I'm an old guy. I just am not home that much.
Right.
I mean, my life is really, now I'm on book tour, so it's even more so. But I do a lot of travel for the magazine work that I do for the Times, and I do a little bit of travel for the opinion section, but even that, my opinion column, even that probably winds up being 30 or 50 days of travel a year. So you put all this stuff together, and I'm on the road more than half the time. So do I cook when I'm at home? Yeah, I do. And I make a joke, which is not... I say something that people find amusing, but is not a joke, and that is I know more about restaurants in London, San Francisco, and Los Angeles than I do about restaurants in New York. Because I go to those places, and every night I eat out, and I go to those places a lot. And in New York, I try to cook at home. So...
That's wonderful. Well, I want to open up the questions.
It? Jesus, okay.
They gave me the 5 minute sign. It went so quickly.
So you're supposed to raise your hand and someone will come to you with a microphone. Then Maureen's going to...
Right here.
There you go.
I think you're amazing. We cooked a lot of your recipes in the New York Times. I have two questions. One... Where did you eat tonight in Philadelphia?
I haven't gone out yet, and I'm not telling you where I'm going. Next question.
Come on.
I'll tweet it or something later on tonight.
Okay.
These poor people, if I say that and 400 of you show up, then what?
Yeah, I was hoping that you were going to make food tonight so that we could taste it. No. So my husband loves you, and we have all your books. I am a principal of an agricultural school in Philadelphia for a high school, and I was just wondering about what you feel about genetically GMOs.
I can answer that question, and I can answer it really quickly. I think that there are a lot of problems with the food system in the United States. Obviously, if you read my column, you know that I think that. I think GMOs are about number 8 on the list, or maybe even 12. And I think that we, the food movement, to the extent there is such a thing, have spent way too much energy fighting GMOs as opposed to fighting some of the other stuff that's wrong here. And that's not to defend GMOs. I just think there are problems in the food system that are actually killing people. And GMOs are not among those problems. If you took GMOs out of the picture, Iowa would still be growing only corn and soybeans, and that's a huge problem, and that's a bigger problem than the fact that the seeds that they're using to grow corn and soybeans are genetically engineered. That's the shortest answer I can give to that question.
Who else has a question? Right here.
She really has held her hand
she
up
has,
quite
I know.
Diligently.
I know.
Yeah. I'm interested in the tools that you use. My husband is from India. And when I go to stay in India, we have 2 little gas plates. And I use a wok and a pressure cooker. And it's amazing what I can produce on those just 2 small implements. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on the tools that you use.
I had a period in my life like that also. I have a 4-burner stove that really only fits 2 pots. I mean, because it's so small, in a pinch you can maybe get 3 things on. I have way too many pots, but that's because when I see a pot I like, I tend to buy it. I mean, I don't do that anymore, but because there's no room to put them. But I rely on the same stuff all the time. I really like a food processor, and it's the only thing that's on my counter other than the coffee maker. But I don't, I don't think it's important to have great equipment, and I don't think it's important to have a lot of equipment. I think it's important to have a good knife. But I think you can get away with a really lousy pot, with really lousy pots and pans. It's also good to have real heat. I mean, to have a stove that's underpowered is usually a drag. But, you know, your big question is, do we focus too much on equipment and not enough on technique and ingredients? And my answer would be, yeah, we do.
Over here.
This person in the middle is never going to get called on. I'm sorry. Sorry, lady.
Go ahead.
Just a quick comment. I'm a huge fan. Your recipes are part of my repertoire. I do cook. I also like your writing. The other day, there was a review of a restaurant in San Francisco, Thai restaurant, and I'm reading along, and I'm thinking of pad Thai noodles. And I'm thinking, probably too pedestrian for what he's eating. It was so great. And all of a sudden, pad something or other, and he said, it blows the doors off every pad Thai noodle you've ever had. And I just want to compliment your writing also. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That's really
blows
nice
blows the
of you.
Doors.
That restaurant's really good, King Cow in San Francisco. That's where I'd be going if we were in San Francisco.
I wanted to say your stuffing recipe is maybe the best thing.
Which one? Wait.
The one with the like two sticks of butter that you say that you would bypass dessert so you could have that stuffing.
But like the one where you'd start with breadcrumbs and as shallots or scallions and tarragon?
Yeah.
That's stolen from James Beard, but it really is
and,
good.
And you admit to that
I admit to that.
So you're speaking about change and needing to change, and my question with that is you can get a lot of recipes now on the internet for free. So how do you keep writing cookbooks and getting people to buy them in a world where everybody thinks that, well, I can just get all of this for free online? How is the cookbook writing world changing?
You can get a lot of my recipes online for free also. But I guess you can't get them curated in one place by me unless you buy the books. And I'd be really worried if I were doing this and I were 35 years old, but I'm not. So I just have to hang on a little bit longer. I think there might be 10 million recipes online. I don't know. Who's telling you what's good? I mean, if I'm telling you what's good and you think I know what I'm talking about, that's what you're buying, is that curation. People are going to buy this book, well, A, I hope because it's good, but, you know, B, because they've come to trust what I do. So that's really nice. You go to recipes.com and look up fast recipes, you are not going to get any wisdom at all. You are just going to get a stack of recipes that might or might not work. So,
wow. All the way in the back.
We are not going to get through this. We have to call on this woman in the middle here. You
go
see
ahead,
the one?
Call on her.
It's like such a hassle for the microphone person. Yeah, you
go
could.
Ahead,
stand
ahead.
Up.
Here we
it's
go.
Like peanuts at a ball game.
Thank you so much. So it's, first of all, my favorite salmon recipe in the world.
Which is
going to
say something really nasty.
No. My favorite salmon recipe in the world is the most simple recipe in the world from you. Salt in a skillet, skin side down for 6 minutes, I think, and flesh for one, and it's perfect. It's totally perfect. And my family from ages 3 through 38, we all love it and we eat it regularly.
Awesome.
Like once a week. So thank you. And the only ingredient is salt. That said, I was obsessed with the PBS. I think it was on PBS, the Spain on the Road Again special. Just give us one or two highlights of being on the road with that crew. I mean, oh, it was Mario God. Batali.
Well, I remember
who. No, I know. But, no, but people around are saying, what is she talking about? So can you just give
it
a
was
little.
Mario Batali, yeah. Who's like one of my favorite human beings ever. Gwyneth Paltrow, who I didn't work with all that much, but we had fun together. And a young woman named Claudia Bissols, who's the same age as my older daughter. I don't know. Claudia was a vegetarian. I was
theoretically vegan before 6, and we were sitting there every morning at 10 o'clock filming us eating ham one place or another. That was my favorite memory, I suppose. It's funny how many people like that show, and it really is fun to watch, but wasn't that much fun to do. Daily life is better. Let's move on.
Okay, back here.
I'm really sorry we called on you.
I wasn't going to call on her. You called on her.
Well, she had such a disadvantaged position. It seemed fair. I was trying to be fair.
In the back.
This is really an amazing audience.
It really is.
I'll they probably go to Washington so well. Tomorrow night and people will be falling asleep in their seats.
Go ahead.
So my question has to do with food blogs. I want to know what you think the role of online health blogs like Thug Kitchen and like Chocolate Covered Katie, what role they play in the food revolution.
I actually don't think my opinion on this is worth that much, but that is where it's happening. That's where a lot is happening. And when people, young people mostly, of course, come in to my office and say, tell me what to do, I want to start a career in food, I say, start blogging and find a voice. I think it's, you know, I was very lucky. My arrogant thing paid off. I got a column in a weekly newspaper when I was 29 years old. You're not going to get that now without some kind of experience, and the only place you're going to get that experience is by blogging. So that's the role. I mean, the sad thing is blogs, for the most part, don't make money. Newspapers, for the most part, don't make money. Therefore, people who try to write about food don't make money, and that's it's difficult to make, you know, to get by. So, but that wasn't your question. They're, you know, anyone can write anything now. You can get out there and prove yourself. And if you have a great voice or you have something great to say, people, it seems, find you. It's a cool thing.
Please describe the most memorable restaurant meal you ever ate.
Okay. Sadly, I don't have the story that Craig Claiborne and Pierre Frenet had when they spent, I think, $10,000, which back in the day when $10,000 meant something, of American Express's money, that they wanted some auction. And Craig would never tell anybody that. He told that story for a year, and then he realized it was the only question anyone ever asked him, so he stopped telling the story. He'd say, I asked him that question, and he said, you don't want to hear that story. I said, I do. No, you don't. It could be the day that I... you said restaurant meal, didn't you? Okay, well, then that's out. That's out, because I cooked that myself. It's really hard. I guess it was this time, it was 1987, I think. It was this time that Jean-Georges von Gerichten moved from Boston to New York and opened a restaurant called Lafayette. And I was working at Cook's Magazine at the time, and we decided to write a story about it. And I went in there, and I met this guy who really turned out to be not my only mentor, but one of my mentors. And he just said, sit down and I'll take care of you. And he just sent out one thing after another, and each thing was a revelation. And I was there probably from 12:30 till 5. And that has happened to me since, but now I don't like it anymore. Now I think this is so silly. But at the time, that level of indulgence and plus the excitement of these things that seemed very new, well, clearly was memorable. I don't remember too many dishes, to tell you the truth, but it was really cool.
Who else has a question? How about right here?
Hi, my daughter asked me to tell you that she learned, she's 12, but when she was 8, she learned how to make scrambled eggs from you, so thank you. but I just wanted to say
probably makes much better scrambled eggs than I did when I was 8. Because my father taught me how to make scrambled eggs. The only thing he knew how to cook.
One of the things that I love, I think, about your cookbooks is, you know, the options, but also the sense that there are kind of worlds of taste that you move people from one to the other. And I would imagine that probably, I don't know, but I wonder if for people who can't cook or feel that they can't cook, maybe one of the barriers is that they don't have the ability to imagine taste. Is that something that you are aware of or have encountered? Or
I think everybody's aware that there are strong flavors, and I think everybody's aware that there are differences among cuisines. I don't think inexperienced people recognize how similar, say, Thai and Mexican food really is, really are. But I think it's a lack of experience. I don't think it's a lack of ability. I just think it's like anything else. You need to learn it. You can't expect to know it because you're such a smart person. You have to experience it.
Well, this is a little serious after all these humorous questions.
We can handle it. Go ahead.
But back to the very beginning of your conversation, I was curious what you would have to say about an article I read maybe in the last couple of days about how Walmart is working now so furiously to have pretty much all their products be organic. And where is that really going if you're saying that only 5% of the whole country is even interested in any of this?
I didn't actually say that, but I think you can market. I think you can market organic food pretty easily. But it pays to remember that organic junk food is still junk food. So I want to know what they're doing, and I want to know where that stuff is coming from. And I would ask you: would you rather have organic grapes from Chile than, you know, in February than real grapes from Pennsylvania in July? So, you know, that might have been sprayed with pesticide at some point. So organic is not a magic word, but it is a magic word in the marketing world, but it's not a magic word in the real world. So it's complicated. It's like the GMO question. It is serious and it's complicated, and it's why it takes me a week to write a column, and it's all this, I think, nicely distilled stuff that is impossible to do verbally, sort of.
Hi. I really love reading your column, and I actually got started in cooking. I took a cooking class in high school, and I'm with my teacher here tonight, but I was wondering what your suggestions are for getting younger generations involved with cooking.
Well, I think your question is answered by your question, but we're going to let Maureen talk about that. Go ahead.
You want me to talk about my...
Yeah.
I have a program that I started. It actually started with my daughter, and some of you may have read about it in the Inquirer, My Daughter's Kitchen. Oh, look, they've all read about it. And so it started with my daughter, who, even though I cooked every night when she got out of college, she was not eating right. She was eating a lot of takeout because, of course, it's so available, and young people are working long hours. So we started this blog, and I would do a recipe, and then she would do it herself. And after a year or so, she couldn't do it any longer. And I said, where can I go? And I decided that, you know, city school children were really the people who needed it the most. And we started with one school, St. Martin de Porres in North Philadelphia. And this fall, we're going to be in 15 schools. I've got 30 volunteers. Before this tonight, I met someone who said, I really want to be a volunteer. So we're expanding every year, and that's our little contribution to getting people cooking. People say, what's your ultimate goal? I said, a program in every school.
Nice work.
So imagine that you are younger, that you are 20 years younger, you are 25, and your girlfriend, she has terrible parents who wanted her to marry a doctor or a lawyer. You are not one of them. Finally, they invited you to their house for a dinner. So you are dressed very nicely, but there is no dinner. They wait for you and they say, well, this is the book. Prove to us that you are really special. Just one dish. Just one dish. Do it. Would you jump over the window or you would cook what?
Chicken parmesan. I answered that.
All right.
And the recipe would
that
work.
That was really good, though.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear what the memorable meal is that you made, the one you thought about.
Oh, well,
about
this is
earlier.
Just a joke, but
No,
it's true. It's a true thing. I mean, memorable can mean many things, right? So I had some really good rice. I don't remember where I came from. I think I had come back from a trip to California where you can grow anything in California. It is amazing. And this Japanese woman whose father was in an internment camp, but whose neighbors, the neighbors of the father, kept the land. A lot of Japanese people lost their land during World War, farmers lost their land during World War II, but this guy came back, got his land back, raised his kids, and his brother and sister run this rice farm now, and I brought some rice back from there. And I made this rice, and I ate it for lunch with salt. And I called my friend Peter, and we were just talking, and he said, "What'd you have for lunch?" I said, "The most amazing lunch. I had this rice with salt." And he reminds me of that all the time. He just thinks it's the funniest thing he ever heard. You obviously did not. But it's, you know, memory, that's how memory works. That's one of my fondest.
Who else has a question right
last
here?
Last time I'll tell that story.
It was really good rice.
Probably the internment camps that got them.
The little Times videos that you and your colleagues make are really terrific and fun and educational and all the rest. But I'm wondering, it looks like it's in your kitchen, and Melissa Clark's looks like it's in her kitchen.
I think it is actually in Melissa Clark's kitchen.
So I'm thinking, like, is it like the sound studio with these series of kitchens and pot handlers, and or is it your kitchen? How does that work?
It's neither. It's New York has, I mean, Philly does too, but New York has dozens, if not scores, of studios that have fake kitchens. I mean, they're real functioning kitchens in them. There's nothing behind the doors of the pantries. That's why they're fake. But no, my kitchen is, I don't know if it's 7x8 or 8x8, but it's somewhere between 56 and 64 square feet. So you don't put cameras in there. No one's seen my kitchen.
Two more questions right here.
Hi. For those of us who are a little more challenged in the kitchen and need a little more help when we're trying to cook every day for ourselves, what are like five or so many ingredients that you think are important to have in your kitchen all the time?
But, you know, I should come up with an answer to this question, because I'm sorry to tell you it's not the first time it's been asked. That is the five ingredients that you haven't thought of that you need to have in the kitchen, because the olive oil, soy sauce, Parmesan cheese, eggs, onions kind of answer is pretty obvious, but maybe that's enough for you. I think the real question is, what are the 100 things you need to have? Because it's not five. Because if you have those five that I just named are really important, but it's not enough. It's enough if you want to eat rice and salt, although I didn't say rice, so I didn't say salt. I think it's 100 things, and I think if you looked in the pantry of someone who really cooks, you would see, you know, you'd see 50 spices, and you'd see three kinds of oils, and you'd see two or three kinds of vinegars, and you'd see capers and anchovies, and a couple of kinds of cheeses, and a bunch of aromatic vegetables, onions, carrots, celery, and eggs, and you'd see a lot of stuff, and you'd see it in there all the time. Maybe a little bit of a rotating cast. You might run out of rice, or you might run out of anchovies, or you might run out of many things, but you need a lot of stuff, and I think that investment in both time and money and thought is so worth it, because especially if you want to cook quickly, you need to have 80 or 90% of the ingredients that you're cooking with on hand already. And then you need to pick up a piece of fish or a vegetable or whatever that night, and that's what you're cooking, but you've got everything else. So it's not five, and all of this stuff is in this book, but it's in most books I've written because pantry is so, so important.
So just listening to you makes me kind of hungry, and the question for you is...
Me too.
Yes, yes. Well, that's we're going to need that restaurant you mentioned. How do you keep from getting fat?
We didn't get to that question.
No,
we
didn't.
The whole B6. Give us the short version. Because you lost like 40 pounds, right?
Yeah. I run and I'm disciplined. And the discipline thing is, it's just essential. But I actually like discipline. So it's not that hard. I let myself get hungry most every afternoon. I have mostly vegan breakfasts and lunches. I have pretty healthy snacks. I don't eat any junk food at all to speak of. I mean, I do break down now and then, but it's not often. And as a result of all of that, I think I lost some weight and it stayed off. And I don't eat as much for dinner as I used to either. So maybe some of it's just age. But I did make an attempt to lose a bunch of weight 7 or 8 years ago, and it worked, and I've kept it off. But it's not a miracle. It's eating the right way and being disciplined enough to keep doing it. I think the running helps, although...
Uh-oh.
Not that I'm showing off my legs, but... Doesn't help right now. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all. It's really fun.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.